Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting with Sarah McDewling. And we're sitting across from Chris Hammer, who's come and talk about his much anticipated and highly praised Scrublands. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we're both in this book at the moment.
Yes.
Like, deep in.
So don't ruin it for us, whatever you do.
But, I mean, for the people listening, we can kind of talk about the opening of the book, right? That's not too spoilery. Because it's what an opening.
Yeah, and it's the first two pages, so yeah, I think we're safe.
So would you mind, for the people listening, setting up a little bit about how your story begins?
Okay, the setup of the book is this. There's a small country town suffering in a drought, way out on a plain, empty plain, and everything seems normal. There's a church service. The young priest is there. He's out chatting with the congregation. Everything seems perfectly normal. He goes inside the church to put on his robes for the service, and then he walks out and he's got a rifle and he shoots five people dead right there and then. And that's it. That's the sort of setting. And you don't know why this has happened. Then the book proper starts. It's like a prologue. The book proper starts, and we're with a journalist called Martin Scarsden, who arrives in the town almost 1 year later. He's been given an assignment, just go and see how the town is coping a year on, because, as you might imagine, it would have been a huge story at the time. So he goes just to see how people are coping, what they think. But as he starts talking to people, he starts suspecting that the conventional wisdom about the story of what happened is maybe not correct, because there are people in the town who still kind of like and admire this homicidal priest.
Mm.
It's one hell of a setup, and it had me
immediately.
Also, it had, like, the one thing that's really wonderful about working in the book industry in Australia is the booksellers talk to each other, and we go to events and people talk, and they tell you, have you started Scrublands yet? And the chit chat around has just been amazing, and the feedback for this book has been amazing, because people get absolutely nutty hooked. And something that readers, I suppose, will enjoy is just how rich it is. Like, it is, it's got so much story. Like, it's not a one trick pony. There's so much going on, and it develops at this wonderful pace that it gets more complicated and more complex, and you didn't see that coming, and holy crap. as we're reading along, I've only got the last probably fifth left to go.
Yeah.
And I've been going home and getting into bed early just so I can spend more time with the book. And most of my weekend was taken up with the book. One question that came through, because I was rabbiting about it on social media, instantly a friend I know from Griffith asked, is he from the area? Is this important? Because it's one of those things that people are very protective about their area. And this is the Riverina in New South Wales, near on the road to Hay. It's set in a fictional town, but it's part of a place that's recognisable. What sort of responsibility do you feel for those kind of for the locals? Because you are writing about your fictional locals with such care.
Well, it's deliberately set in a fictional town, or two fictional towns, because I didn't want anyone to have the idea well, I just didn't get it. I didn't want anyone thinking that this in any way could be related to reality. So the setting, the landscape, if you like, is real, but there's no real connection with any community. And in fact, if you go to small towns out in that area, they're never as self-contained as the town in this book, Riversend, is. You know, it's quite well contained. The protagonist can just walk around, because out there there's so much space, towns tend to spread out far more. So the town itself is totally fictitious. It's not a town that's been rebranded. There is no town that looks anything like that. Well, not one that I know of.
I'm on Google Maps right now going through. Yeah. Where is this town? But in your town, in your fictional town, there are people who have been there for 4 or 5 years or 10 years, and they feel like they're outsiders still.
Yeah.
Do you, you know, when researching this book, were you out there? Did you go around the area? Did you run into these people? Were they suspicious of you and your intents?
So where the setting for the book came from, I did a non-fiction book several years ago called The River, and it was kind of like travel writing, and I was travelling through the whole of the Murray-Darling Basin at the height of the drought trying to explain what had happened. And I went to this one town out there in the Riverina that did have an empty river. The river had run dry, and that was what sort of the setting as I started constructing this fiction it came out of. But I do remember from travelling through the whole of the Murray-Darling Basin during that drought, I'd meet people initially, they'd be cracking hardy and putting on a brave face. But as time went by and I went to different things, I started getting more sensitised, and I picked up just the desperation that was there. You know, it's very difficult if you're a farmer and maybe you're a third or fourth generation farmer. You've inherited this property from your father, from your grandfather, whatever. It's the birthright of your children. And the bank's about to foreclose. It's a terrible thing. And people suiciding and desperate times. And the flip side of that, the resilience, the strength of community, the sort of quiet support there. So those sort of things stayed in my mind. So when I turned to fiction, it was kind of like the setting was there.
Mm.
And that comes through that. The community, the way the community works together. I mean, it's got a lot of heart, this book.
Yeah.
Like, your journalist, Martin, the journalist who comes into town, who is you know, dishevelled or at the, you know, how do you describe him? I'm trying to find the right words for
he's
him.
He's a bit damaged.
Yeah, I see. He's a bit damaged. And he comes in there and some of the newbies in the town kind of attach themselves to him, which gives him some kind of sense of belonging from that first moment. But then he starts to crack, as you did, the older people, like the longer term people, and they start to open up. I just love how you've done this, and it needs to be a longer story to be able to do it in, it's not real time or anything, but in a way in which feels real, that you've given him enough time. And the conversations that he's had with these people and the stuff he's done with them, you know, stuff that they would face, like bushfires and car crashes and things like that, you know, work us as an outsider with him into this little community. It's brilliantly done. I really...
Oh, thank you.
Because it is, you know, it's one of those things that we love to do in Australia. We like to write about smaller towns because it has this sort of... but, you know, I think the character of Martin is what... makes it a little bit different. You're a bit hard on journalists, like in this book. Is there any reason for being so hard on journalists?
No, I was a journalist for 30 years.
That's what I'm saying. Why?
I hadn't thought of it like that. Yeah, some of my old mates might come after me.
Because you've got the TV guys, you've got the heroes of the front page, and you've got Martin who gets his front page, he gets his story, but you know he's in an area of media that's got the most pressure out of all of them.
Probably unconsciously I was looking at how difficult being a journalist is nowadays in that the speed of reporting has just sped up, this constant demand to file all the time. And that also fed into another idea I had about Martin. You often get protagonists in crime books who they might be a bit rough and ready, or they might be carrying some sort of personal baggage, but they usually work their way through things and don't often make mistakes. Whereas Martin makes plenty of mistakes. You know, mainly professional mistakes. You know, he gets the story wrong, which is kind of terrible. But hopefully, the reader is seeing, going, "Oh, I can see what where he was coming from." It just then something else happens, as you say, and it's like, "Oh no, it's wrong." So no, I haven't deliberately set out to be tough on journalists. That's
just
how it came out.
What was it? I wanted to just talk a little bit about your experience writing this, you know, compared to your previous books, which were non-fiction. and like just a little bit about your process.
Well, I tell you, it's writing fiction is so much fun because nonfiction, you have all these constraints, ethical constraints about how you represent people, but more just fact checking. You know, you've got to get things right, and you can't make stuff up. Whereas in fiction, it's incredibly liberating for someone who's been a journalist. You can just make stuff up, and if something, and you can tie things together neatly, which often doesn't happen in real life. So the other thing is, part of the reason I did fiction is because I didn't have the time or resources to travel, so I could just write in my spare time. You know, I was working long hours, family responsibilities, grab a little time here and there to write fiction. So it was kind of a pleasure to do. I loved doing it. Yeah.
So if you got the idea, so I think The River came out in what, 2012, around there, is that the...
2010. And then there was another one called The Coast, so almost like a companion book, which was, I think, 2012, yeah.
So,
and then I ran out of money and went back to work.
So I'm thinking, if 2010's even longer, so you...
The first little germ of an idea.
To turn up in 2018, coming to publication, that's a long period.
It is. So I probably started writing, I reckon, about 2012. So the travel for that, for The River, would have been the summer of 2008, 2009. It was right and on during that next year, 2009. So that big millennial drought was still in full force then. And I was writing a few other things, and then I had this mad idea, which I told you before, of writing a trilogy. So I'd sort of written one book, pretty much a first draft of a second book, and plotted out the third book, and then I realised that didn't work, so that second book kind of went off. So there's a lot of words written that will never see the light of day, which is probably a good thing.
Did the story change a lot in that process of turning it from a trilogy into...
Yeah. And even after it was a single book. But there are plot lines from those latter books that aren't totally wasted. Yeah. So you're always kind of thinking what could happen now and what could happen then. And then also the characters take on a life of their own. I don't know if you've experienced this, John. You sort of set out plot points, you start writing, and then the story starts going off at a bit of a tangent because the characters who are meant to have done such and such sort of stand up and go, hang on a minute, I wouldn't do that.
That's one of my favourite parts. That's where you feel like you're part of the story then, because you're being a bit led by, you're not just, otherwise it'd be boring, I think, writing if everything was exactly as you expected it to be. There's little surprises that come.
I couldn't agree more. If everything ended out, you know, you plotted out over a couple of pages a storyline and that's how it ended up after you've done 100,000 words or something, yeah, what's kind of the point exactly?
It's like drawing by number, you know, drawing by number is not the right thing. So with Scrublands, I'm not at the end. I'm close, so don't do anything troubling to me.
Or to anyone listening.
But I like this character, and I would prefer this character went on to a book three, a book four, a book five, a book six, if possible. I mean, I am talking to the creator here, so he can do what he likes. Is that possible? Is there any chance that he will turn up in another book somewhere?
I'm working on a second book now. He definitely turns up. There's the end of the book is important, I'll put it that way. So it doesn't simply finish with the crime solved. Okay, yeah. There's a bit more to it, and that helps set up the next. So in my mind, I'm thinking book two is underway. Maybe 30,000 words in, so it's going well. You know, touch wood. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of an idea for a third book too. So I think that will happen.
Yeah.
And after that, yeah. I mean, who knows? Who can think? You know.
So does that mean this has a semi cliffhanger ending, or is it fairly
No, it doesn't end on any sort of cliffhanger at all. It is resolved, but there is a resolution. Maybe a slightly unexpected resolution. I don't know. I don't want to.
It's hard. You have to tiptoe around these conversations so that you don't spoil anything. Yeah.
Like, so I suspect some people will get it and some people won't.
Okay. Challenge accepted.
Okay.
This book has not only done incredibly well behind the scenes here before publication, but has sold worldwide, and it's going to be published in the UK, the US, Russia, all these different places, right? But also you've got word coming through that there's a TV show coming. When you were sitting there at, you know, long before publication, you know, writing away and the like, and you see something like The Dry come into favour, and you're like, I'm writing a book about the country, you know, and it's dry. Did things seem a long way away? Are you kind of pinching yourself now at this other side of things where this, I mean, this is what writers dream of. You're experiencing what writers dream.
Yeah, I was so focused on what I was doing, and also I had this idea that I shouldn't read particularly in kind of crime type books because I might lose my voice. So I was actually not, I was unaware that The Dry existed until about the time I was submitting the manuscript, and a friend said, oh, you know, The Dry is just doing so well. The publisher will love this. And
you're
like,
the what now?
I was mortified. I thought, oh, no, people will think, you know, it's a sort of a copy or something, and I won't, you know, and they won't take it. Well, they did. I mean, the agent did. So that was good. But because I'd had this experience writing these other two books, my expectations were I was confident that it was good enough to get a publisher. So I thought, it'll get published, I'll have a book launch, my mates will come along, have a few drinks, slap me on the back, and then I'll go back to my day job. Because that's what happens to writers in Australia, okay? So and then there was this, I mean, a fantastic agent, Grace Heifetz at Curtis Brown. She lined up all these publishers and they were all interested, and suddenly there was this kind of auction going on, and there was this surreal day where I went round and met all these publishers here in Sydney. I came up and Grace and I had coffee first time, said, now what am I saying to them? What, you know, how am I selling this? And she just looked at me and said, no, you're not pitching to them, they're pitching to you. I went, what? And then Grace lined up sort of agents in London and New York who then took it there, and sort of a similar thing happened. So it was really astounding. I mean, maybe a failure of imagination on my behalf, but I didn't kind of realise that this could happen. The good thing about that, and I haven't met Jane Harper, so I don't know, but I suspect for writers like her and Sarah Bailey, like me, they were just writing a book for Australia. So then there's no compromise there, and yet books that are entirely written with an Australian market in mind do have an appeal internationally, including into the United States, which is a fantastic thing. So I've read Jane Harper's books now and Sarah Bailey's and that, and they're fantastic, but they're really Australian. So the fact that there's a market there, and I don't know, I get the impression that maybe 10 or 15 years ago that didn't happen.
So
I feel
you get these isolated things like Thornbirds and then nothing, and then this other success, like a Peter Carey maybe did it in the US. We have this period right now, we have a lot to thank Leanne Moriarty for, I think, because, you know, she was a struggling Australian author, but a best-selling American author for a few years before she became the big thing here with Big Little Lies kind of finally breaking in the Australian market. But she gave, when you read her other books, they're Australian. They're as Australian as anything. They are dominating the US bestseller charts. And I think maybe just gave them a sense that, we can read this. We can cover all that.
The agent in America who represents me and did this is a woman called Faye Bender, and she also represents Leanne Moriarty and Dervla McTiernan as well, and maybe others, I don't know. So I think when Grace presented this to her, she probably went, I can sell this book in America. So I think the success of one or two people in different genres and whatever means that publishers say they like the book, but they also know that they can sell the book. So there's been some magical kind of change there, which I'm very happy about.
Can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, you said during the reading, during your writing, you didn't do much reading the crime, and since then you've gone and read a whole range of them. What were your kind of influences before you wrote? Like, are there writers that you went, oh, if I could even just do quarter as well as they've managed to do, I'll be happy. Who are your sort of your gods?
Sure. So I did English a lot at school, and Canberra's got a different system, so that was good. And I also did it at uni, so I read, I guess, like more like literature, you know, all the standard sort of type text. Never like, I wouldn't say I was a huge like crime fan, but I did at one point, I remember really getting into those hard-boiled detective ones, you know, the Dashiell Hammett sort of Raymond Chandler type things. I really, really like Peter Temple's books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his last two, Broken Shore and Truth, are kind of like a real cut above, you know, your typical sort of crime books. I really like them. He was actually my writing teacher when I was 21.
Oh, wow.
In journalism, before he'd written any fiction. So they sort of influenced me or impressed me. Apart from that, I've read some crime. Like I've read Michael Collins, I've read some Michael Robotham's, and you know there's a kind of gamut there. What kind of appealed to me in crime was there's room in crime. You have to have a good plot. I think you can't get away from that. But on top of that, there's a lot of space for character and also kind of psychological, because, you know, crime, it's typically murder, okay? And that's a major transgression. You know, people don't go around killing each other. So why has someone killed someone? And I think there's a lot of space in there for
character studies.
To do some nice writing and some character studies and that. So that's kind of what attracted me into that.
Well, that's why I like reading it.
Yeah,
and we're seeing more in this last book, because we're seeing, you know, crime sort of went away for a bit and everyone started doing MasterChef. And now it seems to be dominating the markets. It was, you know, and then colouring books and the rest of it. But crime seems to be coming back in force in Australian reading.
Australian crime especially.
Yeah, Australian crime. It's just really, and everyone seems to be back reading crime, whether or not it has to do with realities of life or who knows what are the reasons why these things suddenly happen.
It may have a bit. There's a lot of crime I notice on television. So if you're looking at SBS On Demand or Netflix or Stan, it's something that translates well, and maybe that's feeding back into people reading books. It's
I think like you were saying when you were comparing writing fiction to writing non-fiction, I think part of the appeal of crime is that when you're in a world and things don't always work well or they're working particularly badly, there's a formula to a crime novel where you can go into it knowing that no matter how bad things get, you'll probably have a resolution by the end of it. That's reassuring.
Because if you look at the world we live in, you're going, what is going to happen next?
I'd like to go into a reality like this, but where things work out well.
I think maybe for readers of crime too, if they pick up a crime book, they kind of know what they're getting. There's going to be a crime, and as you say, at the end, there'll be a resolution, and in the middle there'll be a kind of a journey. So it's kind of the constraints there. People know what they're getting, but it can still be very interesting too.
There's always a puzzle element to it.
Yeah, it's possibly the same with romance writing, for example. I don't know if I've ever read a romance book, but, you know, I think, you know, you have whatever happens, the expectations that it's going to end happily. Mm. So you're not buying the book because you want to really find out, you know, whether they get together or not. It's that journey.
Chris, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, well, thank you for the support.
And you can get hold of Scrublands at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.